White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Gentlemen, and welcome to the August 29th, 2013 edition. I'm trying to save something here. Sorry. 2013 edition. Episode 62 edition of The International Jew. Very sorry for messing around like that. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and
I am Hadding Scott.
And we are here to bring you another very good chapter. It is the real lowdown on Paul Warburg. It's the first of two chapters about Paul Warburg and the American Federal Reserve banking system. And then there's a little more, another chapter about, you know, more money stuff coming up after that. But this one is titled Jewish Idea in American Monetary Affairs. And it starts out mentioning a Mr. Brisbane, but it doesn't even give his first name or say anything about who he is. I guess you're supposed to remember from all the way back in Chapter 7, which was our Episode 9, that was titled Arthur Brisbane Leaps to the Help of Jewry. And so I wanted to bring that up to you so you know what they're talking about when they mention him. And he was an editor of the New York Journal, which was a Hearst newspaper, and he worked for Hearst Papers all his life, and as it says here, he was always helpful to Jewry. So, do you want to add anything to that, Hattie?
Nope.
Okay, so Hattie's going to read as usual, but I'm going to read the part of Mr. Warburg, Paul Warburg, and we're going to have, there's parts of this that are the, a Senate hearing, investigative hearing or something like that. And so to make it clear who's speaking, I'll just read that part. Okay.
All right. Chapter 57. Jewish Idea in American Money Affairs, Monetary Affairs. Mr. Brisbane says that Jewish bankers exercise their large measure of control because they are abler than other bankers. It was very good of Mr. Brisbane to say so, and it adds to the sum of his weekly, almost daily, worship at the Jewish shrine. But it is scarcely true. Jewish bankers do not yet control the United States, and the principal reason they do not is that they are not abler than the other bankers. Doubtless they seek control. Doubtless they have almost grasped it on several occasions, but not yet. Nevertheless, they form such a formidable force, and with their international connections constitute such a political problem, that the mere fact of their failing to top the column of control is not so reassuring as it sounds. The great Jewish banking houses of the United States are foreign importations, as perhaps everyone knows. Most of them are sufficiently recent to be considered in their immigrant status, while the thought of them as aliens is stimulated by their retention of overseas connections. It is this international quality of the Jewish banking group which largely accounts for Jewish financial power. There is team play, intimate understandings, and while there is a margin of competition among themselves, as at golf, there is also a wiping out of that margin when it comes to a contest between Jewish and Gentile capital. Four conspicuous contemporary names in Jewish American finance are Belmont, Schiff, Warburg, and Kahn. All of them, even the most recent, are of foreign origin.
Yeah, I'll just tell the listeners that Kahn is spelled K-A-H-N, so you can visualize, you know, what that is.
August Belmont was the earliest and arrived in America in 1837 as the American representative of the Rothschilds, in whose offices he had been raised. His birthplace was that great center of Jewish international finance, Frankfurt on the Main. He became the founder of the Belmont family in America, which has largely forgotten its Jewish origin. Politics was a large part of his concern in this country, and during the critical time from 1860 to 1872, he was chairman of the National Democratic Committee. His management of the Rothschild interests was exceedingly profitable to that house, although the operations in which he engaged were quite simple compared with the operations of the present day. Jacob Schiff is another Jewish financier who was given to the world by Frankfurt on the Main. He entered the United States in 1865, after having passed his apprenticeship in the office of his father, who was also an agent of the Rothschilds. The name Schiff runs a long way back without change, unlike the name of Rothschild. Originally named Bauer, this family of financiers took a new name from the Red Shield, which adorned their house in the Jewish section of Frankfurt, and thus became Rothschild. Commonly, the last syllable is pronounced as if it were child. It is Shield. Shield. An epoch-making family in itself, it has trained hundreds of agents and apprentices, of whom Jacob H. Schiff was one.
Hey, you know, can I break in? Don't you think it would be a good idea if it would be encouraged to pronounce Rothschild as Rothschild, because it sounds more Jewish, and it just doesn't sound as friendly. Rothschild. That's what it should be, right?
Well, everybody says Rothschild, so.
Well, I know, because it sounds more, you know, anglicized, I guess. Okay.
I think there's already a cloud around the name Rothschild.
It is.
You know, you kind of dissipate that a little bit if you pronounce it differently, I think.
Okay.
Jacob H. Schiff was one. He became one of the principal channels through which German Jewish capital flowed into American undertakings. And his agency in these matters gave him a place in many important departments of American business, especially railroads, banks, insurance companies, and telegraph companies. He married Teresa Loeb, and in due time came to be head of the firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. Mr. Schiff, too, was interested in politics with a Jewish angle, and was perhaps the moving force in the campaign which forced Congress and the president to break off treaty relations with Russia, then a friendly nation, on a strictly Jewish question which had been skillfully given an American aspect. Mr. Schiff was of inestimable assistance to Japan in the war against Russia, but is understood to have been disappointed by Japan's shrewdness in preventing too high a return being made for that assistance.
Do you want to comment anything on that? Any background on that?
About the Russo-Japanese War.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and that Schiff and the Jews were trying to help Japan hurt Russia in that case. Because they were as part of their program against Russia.
I think probably they were willing to give financial assistance to Japan without a very high return, just for the fact that it involved hurting Russia.
Well, right, exactly. That's what they are up to. So they are working then on world events and controlling world events. And their big aim at the time was to harm Russia. Why did they hate Russia so much? Because Russia had this program, had this strength against the Jews in Russia, the Tsar. That's the only reason, isn't it? I mean, the Tsar was very strong and firm against allowing Jews to get control in the.
Well, I think it was it may have been the last absolute monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very strong, strong enough to keep the Jews contained. I think there were some other reasons that also related to preventing Jews from doing things that they wanted to do. I can't tell you the whole story. I think Matthew Raphael Johnson has some information about that.
But the thing was, it was all because they didn't like Russia's attitude toward the Jews. It was all about the Jews.
Well, it's not just their attitude, but the fact that an absolute monarch can keep the Jews from doing all kinds of things that they want to do.
Well, that's
if you have a liberal system or an electoral system, where anybody can be a citizen, that's the kind of system the Jews like best, because they can come in and there's enough chaos that they can manipulate things and get away with things. That's what they like.
Yeah. So it was all about, making things better for the Jews is what I only point I'm trying to make.
Yeah.
That these guys back then were already working in concert to help the Jews worldwide, internationally, So we get that picture.
Associated with Mr. Schiff in Kuhn, Loeb & Company is Otto Hermann Kahn, who is probably more international than were either of the two gentlemen mentioned above, and is more constantly engaged in dabbling in mysterious matters of an international nature. This characteristic may be accounted for, however, by his experience of many countries. He was born in Germany and is also a product of the Frankfurt on Main School of Finance, having had connection with the Frankfurt Jewish House of Speyer. Of just how many countries Mr. Kahn has been a citizen is a question not easy to determine here, because of the doubt that was recently cast upon his American citizenship by a protest against his being permitted to cast his vote last year, and by his failure, the announced cause being physical indisposition, to cast his vote. If Mr. Kahn is a citizen of the United States, a status that will be readily proclaimed upon proof that he is, that probably increases the number of his citizenships to 3. He was a German citizen by birth and served in the German army. And in 1914, in August, at the time of the outbreak of the European War, when efforts were being made, which afterwards succeeded, to put Paul M. Warburg, a member of the firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company, on the Federal Reserve Board, Mr. Warburg testified that at that time, Mr. Kahn was not a citizen of the United States.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Mr. Kahn was not ever a citizen of the United States, and he was saying that he was going to go and vote. And then when some word about it came out, he got ill and couldn't go and vote. I think that's very funny.
Yeah. Well, they leave open the possibility that he might somehow be a citizen of the United States, but it looks suspiciously as if he is not.
Right.
All right. Here we go. This is a senatorial committee questioning here. Senator Bristow, how many of these partners are American citizens, or are they all American citizens, Mr. Warburg?
They are all American citizens, except Mr. Kahn.
Senator Bristow, now, the members of your firm, are they all American citizens except Mr. Kahn? Mr. Warburg.
Yeah, I think you can probably leave off the two things, since now people know that I'm Mr. Warburg and you're Senator Bristow.
Mm-hmm.
So, except Mr. Kahn, yes.
Was Mr. Kahn ever an American citizen?
No.
He never was?
No, he is a British subject.
He is a British subject.
Yes.
Okay, that's not what it says here.
Well, I have Mr. Warburg, no, he is a British subject, and then the chairman comes in. I might have left something out, I don't know.
Seems that way.
Okay, what do you have?
Well, oh, the chairman says, yeah, oh.
Yeah, the chairman.
The chairman.
He lives in England, does he not?
No. At one time, he thought he would move to Europe, and that was when the question arose of his standing for Parliament. Then he changed his mind and moved back to the United States.
He was at one time a candidate or a prospective candidate for Parliament, was he not?
No, he was not, but there was talk about it. It had been suggested, and he had it in his mind. Something had been written about it in the papers.
So, that if Mr. Kahn is a citizenship of the United States now, which, as a matter of fact, has been disputed, then he has been a citizen of three countries, Germany and Great Britain being the other two. Mr. Kahn, by the way, is one of those Jews whose adoption of another form of faith brings no denunciation whatever from the Jews themselves. A most peculiar circumstance, but doubtless not inexplicable. Mr. Kahn is not called a renegade Jew, nor any of the other nasty names heaped upon Jewish converts to Christianity, because he does not deserve them. They would not fit him. He is not renegade, and he never was regarded for a moment by Jacob H. Schiff as anything but a Jew, else that Prince of Israel would not have chosen him to remain in America and run the business of Kuhn, Loeb, and Company at a time when it seemed undesirable to put the junior Schiff in full charge of it. Doubtless it was Mr. Kahn's desire, just at the time Jacob Schiff made his wishes known, to go to England and stand for Parliament. But from New York he fulfills, probably as well as he could from London, all those mysterious missions which frequently take him to the continent, at which times he makes what are regarded as certain authoritative decisions, though just whose decisions it is not always possible to say. In Paris particularly, and at points east thereof, Mr. Kahn has been established in the position of spokesman of the American financial hierarchy, which of course he is not. But he undoubtedly is the spokesman of some group, possibly the group which so ably put through the Jewish program at the peace conference, the group that impressed Eastern Europe with the feeling that the United States of America was a very powerful Semitic empire. Mr. Kahn's trips abroad are usually unheralded, but their results richly repay observation. A fourth member of the Jewish financial group in America, which is the form of statement which Mr. Chaim Weizmann would sanction rather than to say Jewish American financiers, is Mr. Paul Warburg, to whose testimony we have just alluded. Mr. Warburg is the most recent of all. He was born in Germany in 1868. He came to the United States in 1902. He became an American citizen in 1911. He came to the United States for the express purpose of reforming our financial system. And it is hardly possible to understand fully the system in operation today without reference to Paul Warburg. He is a man of very fine mind, a moneymaker, but something more. A shrewd student of the systems by which money is made. There are two types engaged in the work, in the mere work of making money, which is better described as money getting, without reference to production. One type grubs away under whatever system obtains, regarding it as fixed as the solar system. Another type is sufficiently detached to see the system as an artifice, which may be mended, remodeled, or supplanted altogether. Paul Warburg, scion of a long line of German Jewish bankers, is of the latter type. He is not content with the fact that the cash register fills itself with money. He wants also to know how the cash register works and whether it can be worked. He is thus a student of money and of the number of ways in which it can be manipulated. Perhaps it will be best to let him tell his own story as far as it goes. When he told it to the Committee on Banking and Currency of the United States Senate in executive session, there was some dispute as to whether the proceeding should be recorded by the stenographer. It was finally agreed that notes should be made, but should not be divulged. The testimony was printed in confidence on August 5th, 1914, and nominally made public on August 12th. The Warburgs are one of the international families whose importance was not realized until the war, and would not have been realized then if their internationalism had not been so apparent. It was an interesting spectacle to see brothers occupying important places of counsel on either side of the great struggle.
See, I think that's really important there, isn't it? People should take note of that. There you have this family and these two brothers, both bankers and from the same banking family and all. You know, one's in Germany and one's in the United States. You think they're not conferring with one another?
And then they both participated, I think, in the peace conference, didn't they?
Yeah, and this was all going on during the war and everything. Really amazing.
Paul Warburg learned the rudiments of banking in his father's bank at Hamburg, Germany, studying the overseas trade, which is the foundation of that city's business. The banking house of Warburg in Hamburg dates from 1796. After that, I went... Oh, excuse me, this is Mr. Warburg speaking.
Yeah, I guess this is testimony, so I'll read it. After that, I went to England, where I stayed for 2 years, first in the banking and discount firm of Samuel Montague and Company, and after that, I took the opportunity of staying 2 months in the office of a stockbroker in order to learn that part of the business. After that, I went to France, where I stayed in a French bank, so that...
Chairman says,
What French bank was that?
It is the Russian Bank for Foreign Trade, which has an agency in Paris. And after that, I went back to Hamburg and worked there again for a year, I think. Then I went round to India, China, and Japan. And then I came to this country for the first time in 1893. I stayed here only a short time then, and went back to Hamburg, then became a partner in the firm in Hamburg.
How long were you in Hamburg then in the banking business?
Until 1902, and then I moved over here to this country to become a partner of Kuhn, Loeb and Company. I explained in the curriculum which I gave you, Mr. Chairman, that by marriage I am related to members of the firm, the late Mr. Loeb having been my father-in-law, which brought about a desire on the part of the family to bring me over here. I ought to say that I got married in this country in 1895, and that I have been in this country every year since for several months. That is my history. That is the history of my banking education.
It will be recalled that Jacob H. Schiff also married a daughter of Mr. Loeb, so that Mr. Warburg married the sister of Mrs. Jacob H. Schiff. Felix Warburg, Paul's brother, who is also in the firm, married Mr. Schiff's daughter.
Yeah, see, now isn't this interesting? Now, he came over here visiting in 95 or something, and somewhere around there while he was here, he married this Loeb daughter, and then he went back to Hamburg and stuff, and then when he came back, you know, he brought, you know, so he married this woman probably knowing already what they were all going to be up to. I bet you they already had something worked out.
Mr. Warburg immediately cast a critical eye upon the state of financial affairs in the United States, and it is significant of the grasp he already had on such matters that he found the country rather behind the times. He conceived the ambition, the very daring ambition, of taking hold of the United States monetary system and making it what he thought it ought to be. This alone would make him a remarkable man. It illustrates very well that detached point of view, which the Jew is more fitted to take than any other man, perhaps. He sees countries and systems with the same freedom from intimate bias with which another man would view assorted fish upon a market stall. Most of the world is engaged in doing its work and indulging its national, racial, domestic, and social affections and inclinations. A small minority stands in the background and watches the entire mass at its unconscious maneuvers and studies it as an observer studies a hive of bees. The man at work has no time except for his job. One man, standing back and studying 1,000 men at work, is able to see how he might utilize their labor or possess himself of a first toll on their production. Doubtless there must be men to stand at a sufficient distance from things to get a correct idea of their interrelationship, and doubtless such an attitude may be made of great service to the race. But doubtless it has also contributed to the selfish manipulation of natural and social processes. Mr. Warburg testified,
"When I came here, I was at once impressed by the lack of system, by the old-fashioned nature of the system that prevailed here. And I got immediately into one of those periods of high interest rates where call money went up to 25% and 100%. And I wrote an article on the subject then and there for my own benefit. I was not here 3 weeks before I was trying to explain to myself the roots of the evil. I showed the article to a few friends, but I kept it in my desk because I did not want to be one of those who try to inform and educate the country after they have been here for a month or so. And I kept that article until the end of 1906, shortly before the panic, when those conditions arose again, and when one newspaper wanted for an issue at the end of the year an article dealing with the conditions in our country. Then I took out that article and touched it up and brought it to date, and that was the first article of mine that was published. It was called Defects and Needs of Our Banking System."
Of our banking system?
Yeah, our. That was, however, the first time that I know of that, the question of the discount system and the concentration of reserves was really brought out, and I got a great many encouraging letters asking me to go on and explain my ideas.
Mr. Warburg was perfectly willing to talk to the committee about himself, but not about Kuhn, Loeb & Company, his firm.
Well, before I go into that, I wanted to bring up, ask you, Hadding, if you understand, I was going to look this up, but I ran out of time before the show. But what was meant by currency reform? What was wrong with our currency that we needed currency reform, which supposedly was what coming up with the Federal Reserve System was all about.
Well, you know, I'm not really an expert on this, but they had a lot of problems with banks closing because they didn't have enough gold on stock to redeem money that when people demanded it, things like that. One of the things they did was called pyramid lending, where one bank, they did partial reserve banking where you could lend out 10 times what you had. Mm-hmm. So one bank would have X amount of gold, and then they would lend out, you know, 10X amount of notes.
Yeah.
And then, then other banks would take one of those notes and then lend out 10 times that much. So there would end up being, you know, 100 times the amount of money lent out compared to the amount of gold that there was backing it.
Well, supposedly, then they say that, you know, in Europe, they had solved these problems, or they had a better system in Europe. And we needed to catch up with that, and that's what this was all about, making it more like what the central banking in Europe. Do you know anything about that, about why that, what Europe had, and if they were doing what our Federal Reserve turned out to be?
I can't really talk about it. There was some kind of a thing with a gold-backed currency in Prussia, but I don't know much about it.
Well, anyway, they convinced everyone that we needed currency reform, that we had terrible defects in our banking system, didn't they? And so they were going to fix it. And these newcomers, these Jews coming over.
Well, there were some problems. There were some
problems. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I can believe that. So that's.
All right. So Mr. Warburg was perfectly willing to talk to the committee about himself, but not about Kuhn, Loeb & Company, his firm.
I cannot discuss the affairs of my firm, nor my partners, he said, nor be asked to criticize acts of my partners, either to approve them or in any other way.
But eventually he did tell a number of things which students of American financial affairs have considered interesting, of which more later. On page 77 of the testimony, more personal matters appear.
When did you become a citizen of the United States, Mr. Warburg?
1911. Did I not answer that?
Perhaps so. Did you intend to become a citizen when you came to the United States in 1902?
Yes. No, 1902. I lost my place here. Sorry.
You did,
I'm on 1911. Well, how can it be? More personal. When did you become a citizen? 1911. You asked me if I had intended to become a citizen when I came to the United States. Sorry. I had no definite intentions then because some of the reasons that brought me over here were family reasons. That had a good deal to do with my first coming here, and I was not at all sure that I would stay here when I came.
When did you decide to become a citizen of the United States?
In 1908, when I took out my papers.
When you took out your first papers, you took out your second papers then in 1911?
Yes.
You made your declaration in 1908. That is when you decided to become an American citizen?
Yes.
Why did you wait as long as you did after you came to this country before deciding to become a citizen of this country?
I think that a man that does not come here as an immigrant, a man who has had, if you may call it such, a prominent position in his own country, will not give up his nationality so easily as a man who comes over here knowing that he does not care for his own country at all. I had been a very loyal citizen of my own country, and I think that a man who hesitates in giving up his own nationality and taking a new one is apt to be more loyal to his new country when he does change his nationality than a man who gives up his old country more lightly.
Yes?
I may add this, that a thing which had a great deal of influence on my making up my mind to remain in this country and work here and become a part and parcel of this country was that monetary reform work for which I felt I had a distinct duty to perform here. And I thought I could do that. And in fact, I have been working on it since 1906 or 1907. Then I felt that it was the right thing for me to become an American citizen and work here and throw in my lot definitely with this country.
Yeah, when you became an American citizen, and the motive which induced you to become an American citizen was then, as I understand it, largely with a view of laboring to bring about a reform of the American monetary system?
Well, you put it nearly exclusively on that. I think a man wants to feel that he's going to do some useful work in his country, that he has a mission to perform, and that is what happened to me. Moreover, I had been long enough in this country then to have thoroughly taken root and feel that I was part and parcel of it.
Yes. When did you first become active in promoting the monetary reforms in the United States?
1906.
What was your method of promoting your ideas with regard to monetary reforms?
Mainly writing.
Were you connected with the Monetary Commission?
No, not directly.
Were you consulted in regard to the report of the Monetary Commission in any way?
Yes, Senator Aldrich consulted me about details. Is that right? And I gave him my advice freely.
And in regard to the bill, which was prepared by Senator Aldrich in connection with the commission, were you consulted in regard to that?
Yes.
What part did you have in the preparation of that bill, directly or indirectly?
Well, only that I gave the best advice that I could give.
Yeah. Most readers will recall that the name of Aldrich was, a few years ago, the synonym for the money power in government. Senator Aldrich was an able man and a tireless worker. His character for thoroughness and industry did more than anything else to disabuse the popular mind of the notion that such men were mere tools of the money interest, or engaged in their work out of lust for gain, or out of sheer pleasure in legislating against the interests of the people. Senator Aldrich led on tariff and financial matters because he understood them, and he understood them by tireless study of them, and therefore he was the master of other men who had not paid the price of knowledge. But he understood these matters from the standpoint of the business interest only. He was sincerely desirous of the prosperity of the country, but that prosperity was written in banking balances. 15 years ago, it might not have been possible to judge him thus calmly, because then he represented in the public mind, more than any individual does today, the concentrated power of the financial group. Their prosperity was his first care, possibly because he believed that their prosperity was also the country's. That's sort of the Republican ideology today. Let the rich get as rich as possible. It'll help everybody else somehow.
Yeah.
It was such a man, then, that came to Mr. Warburg for assistance, for advice. The labors of Senator Aldrich comprise many volumes of difficult material, and Senator Aldrich's appeal to Mr. Warburg was a very high compliment to the quality of the latter's mind and financial experience. This, of course, assuming that Mr. Warburg's counsel was not forced upon the Aldrich Committee by the New York money interests. In his testimony, Mr. Warburg did not tell all.
The omission, however, was supplied by an article in Leslie's Weekly in 1916, the author being B.C. Forbes. It is a story of which current opinion said, "It reads like the opening in a shilling shocker." It appears that the conferences between Mr. Warburg and Senator Aldrich took place on an isolated island off the coast of Georgia, Jekyll Island. Included in the party, besides Senator Aldrich and Mr. Warburg, were two New York bankers and the then Assistant Treasurer of the United States. The mysteriousness of it all was well brought out by Mr. Forbes. Picture a party of the nation's greatest bankers stealing out of New York on a private railroad car under cover of darkness, stealthily hieing hundreds of miles south, embarking on a mysterious launch, sneaking out to an island deserted by all but a few servants, living there a full week under such a rigid secrecy that the name of not one of them was once mentioned, lest the servitors learn their identity and disclose to the world this strangest, most secret episode in the history of American finance. The utmost secrecy was enjoined upon all. The public must not glean a hint of what was to be done. Senator Aldrich notified each one to go quietly into a private car, which the railroad had received orders to draw up at an unfrequented platform. Drawn blinds bulked any peering eyes that might be around. Off the party set. New York's ubiquitous reporters had been foiled. So far, so good. After bowling along the railroad hour after hour into southern country, the order was given to prepare to disembark. Stepping down from the car, when the station had been well cleared of travelers, the members of the expedition embarked in a small boat. Silence reigned, for the boatmen must not find out how distinguished were their passengers. In due time, they drew up at another deserted pier. They were at Jekyll Island, off Georgia. The island was entirely unpeopled, save for half a dozen servants. The servants must under no circumstances learn who they are, who we are, cautioned Senator Aldrich. What can we do to fool them? Asked another member of the group. The problem was discussed. I have it, cried one. Let's all call each other by our first names. Don't ever let us mention our last names. So it was agreed. The dignified veteran Senator Aldrich, King of Rhode Island, and a power second to none in the United States Senate, became just Nelson. And the quiet, scholarly member of the powerful international banking firm of Kuhn, Loeb, and Company became Paul. Nelson had meanwhile confided to Harry, Frank, Paul, and Piatt that he was to keep them locked up on Jekyll Island, cut off from the rest of the world, until they had evolved and compiled a scientific currency system for the United States, a system that would embody all that was best in Europe, yet so modeled that it could serve a country measuring thousands, where European countries measured only hundreds of miles. Mr. Forbes does not omit to write this further description of Mr. Warburg's condition at the time. Unable then to speak idiomatic English with perfect freedom and without an accent, an alien not naturalized. Mr. Forbes also wrote, Here is a German-American, but the sort of one that makes the hyphen look like a badge of honor. That was in 1916. Hyphens went out of fashion, though not entirely out of use, soon after. Thus far, the story of Paul Warburg.
Well, we finished that early. Yeah. I'm surprised because I put it in word count, and it showed it was, 4,400, which is on the long side, but anyway, I guess we were pretty efficient here. So I will. There's some things to talk about, though. So that's just as well. Although we've got 15 minutes, and I will say, if anybody wants to call in, and we don't usually get any callers on this show, but if you would want to,
yeah, for any Federal Reserve conspiracy theorists out there, here's your chance to say all
there
your
you
beliefs.
Go. 830-443-4911. Now, something I wanted to bring up. I know. One thing here I want to say at the end. They say, here, Mr. Forbes also wrote about Warburg. Here is a German-American, but the sort of one that makes the hyphen look like a badge of honor. Well, I say Jewish-American. You know, and this is probably reveals the single biggest mistake that was ever made, and that is, you know, forgetting to call these people Jewish. They were always calling him German. They never called him Jewish, except the International Jew calls him Jewish, but I don't think he generally was.
And you're not supposed to mention that they're Jewish unless it's complimentary.
Yeah, and so by not naming the Jews, these people get away with, they still think of him as a German-American. Unless they want, the Jews want to be proud of him, you know, and brag on him. But anyway, I came across an interesting little piece of something here. It was in the Jewish Telegraph Agency in 1932, and it was a story that headlined, Mr. Paul M. Warburg, Seriously Ill, Founder of American Federal Reserve. Now, I forgot to check exactly when he died, but anyway, he was seriously ill in pneumonia, and this may be when he died. It was in 1932, and it says here, it mentions Henry Ford, and it says here in this story then, a year ago, Mr. Warburg delivered a speech in New York decrying the American isolation theory and advising the United States to seek larger international cooperation and courageous action to help the world to emerge from the stagnation into which it has fallen. He was promoting war in 1931, that, you know, we need to get over this isolationism and be prepared to go to war. And when Mr. Henry Ford, then it goes on to say, when Mr. Henry Ford was still conducting his anti-Semitic campaign, he launched an attack on Mr. Paul Warburg in 1925, accusing him of being the head and front of a movement in which the Federal Reserve System was being used as an instrument to foist German financial methods on the United States and to bring about a German control of American industry and business. Now, you know, you see how the Jewish Telegraph Agency won't call it Jewish at this time. Mr. Bernard Baruch and Mr. Aaron Shapiro, that was the guy who actually brought the suit, whose libel action against Mr. Henry Ford was the immediate point which brought about his recantation of his anti-Semitism, were included with Mr. Paul Warburg as his chief assistants in the plot. So I guess he means that Henry Ford was including for Baruch and Shapiro in his plot about the Federal Reserve, but he really didn't do that. He didn't accuse us. Well, he said one thing about Shapiro, and Shapiro got all upset and brought a big lawsuit and built it up into something, and that just was a real problem. It was an inconvenience and a pesky kind of thing for Henry Ford, but after it got thrown out, it actually became one of the jurors did something wrong, and so it became not a hung jury, but the whole case had to be thrown out, and it would have had to been started over again, and this Shapiro was going to start it all over again, but at that point Henry Ford had had enough, and he did his recantation thing. Now this is some more of it. Must be, it says the Pacific Banker. Yeah, the Pacific, this is what the article was written in. The Pacific Banker, the leading financial paper in the Northwest, dismissed the accusation by Henry Ford against these people, as I guess against Warburg, as a ridiculous obsession, and wrote, "Paul M. Warburg," and that's his name is Moritz, Paul Moritz Warburg, "is a name which stands very high in American banking as that of the man who laid down the central idea upon which the whole Federal Reserve System was erected, who cast aside all thought of remuneration, that is, getting paid anything, to become a member of the original board, in fact, its deputy governor, who has shown a genius in sound finance and wholehearted service to the country, which is recognized everywhere in responsible quarters." So, that's what they were saying about him, and that's the way they want to present him, that he's done this great service in bringing us the Federal Reserve system, which we really needed.
Yeah, if you look at the way he responded to Bristow's and the chairman's questions, he's asked specific questions about what he did, and he would always answer, "Well, a man does blah, 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 blah." You know, it gives all these abstractions about what a man would do. And, it just doesn't seem very straightforward.
Well, no, he's evasive, you know, but he's pretty smooth. You know, I mean, he knew what he would say and what he wouldn't say. And another thing that came up all the time, which comes up more, I think, in the next chapter, is that he was always saying he couldn't give any, he wouldn't talk about his firm or his partners. He couldn't give any, answer any questions that had to do with his partners. And so he would only answer questions that had to do with himself. But I think that this Bristow that you were reading there, you said he was a senator from Kentucky, and he's asking all the
No, he was from Kansas, but he was born in Kentucky.
Oh, okay. Kansas senator. Well, he was asking all the right questions. And so often in all these Senate hearings, they do ask the right questions, but they don't push the person in the witness chair to answer. They're so gentlemanly, you know. Of course, they're not on the witness stand. And I guess they do take some kind of an oath, though, don't they, when they're in these Senate investigatory hearings? But, you know, they're so gentlemanly, and if they don't want to answer, or if they give a deceptive answer or whatever, they don't push it. They don't push anything. And in the end, nothing comes of these hearings. Most of the time. Do you think? Don't you think?
I don't know.
Well, that's what I don't think these questions were, you know, they didn't, they were good questions, but he didn't push it to the limit. He just like suggests, well, you know, is there some kind of a plot going on here? But then I think they just drop it. So then we come back to the conspiracy thing. So they're suggesting, even the senator, at least the parts that the International Jew picked out to point out, they're suggesting that there is a conspiracy, but they don't try too hard to. I don't know who else they questioned. They're not going to get it from Warburg. And you were just saying what people, conspiracy theorists, can call in. So you don't. So what is your impression then of how the Federal Reserve came about? I did read that book, The Jekyll Island, the Creature from Jekyll Island. Oh, I read that in 1997. I remember very well when and why and what was going on. It made a big impression on me. It was probably the beginning.
Right. Well, you know, my main concern about the Federal Reserve is the fact that since these private bankers are involved in it, and since they make these decisions behind closed doors, it's possible for people to have foreknowledge of what the Federal Reserve policies are going to be and to make a killing with that foreknowledge through speculation. See, that's the main concern that I have about it. The other people have other theories. I'm not entirely sure how much there is to them. Some people say that we can never pay off the national debt because of the way the Federal Reserve is set up. But the debt has gone up and down since the national debt has gone up and down since the Federal Reserve was established. It went way up during the Second World War, and then it went down for a long time. And recently it started going way up again. So I'm not sure how much water that holds. I think there's some misinformation about the Federal Reserve. The way the Federal Reserve is set up is similar to some other entities that are sort of semi-governmental, like the Federal Communications Commission. If you see a body connected to the federal government with the word commission in its name, that means it's kind of semi part of the government. I think the first one that they set up that way was the Interstate Commerce Commission. But the reason why they did that, I believe, is because they wanted to get away from having a gold and silver backed currency, because there are problems related to that. And by having an entity that was not, strictly speaking, the government issuing a quasi-currency, they could have it not backed by gold and silver.
They took control of the United States monetary supply. So I can't think that it's just so that they could make money. The one difference between you and I is that you often say, well, they do this because they can make a lot of money this way, and that's what they're interested in. They're not interested in actually taking over anything because they don't want the responsibility for it and so on. But I would say they're always taking over, and they've taken over the entire U.S. monetary supply, and they work it as they will. Sure, they make money, but they do a lot more. They're actually destroying this country. Or they're destroying any way for the people, the European people of this country, to be in control of what's going on. You deny that?
Well, yeah, but most of their power is through ownership of mass media.
Well, we're not talking about mass media. We're talking about the Federal Reserve and the banking system and the monetary supply.
I'm skeptical as to whether all the conspiracy claims about the Federal Reserve are true. I think they should have amended the Constitution to make the currency, make it possible for the United States government to issue currency without gold and silver backing. That would have been the proper way to do it, but it would have been politically difficult. So they went this kind of jerry-rigged way instead. And as I said, it is possible that people who get inside information on what the Federal Reserve's policies are going to be can make a killing on those. And it's supposed to be, even though the president appoints the head of the Federal Reserve, he's always some Jewish banker, or at least a banker anyway, a private banker.
He's more and more a Jew. More and more, it's only going to be a Jew from now on.
Anyway, I think the importance of the Federal Reserve is a bit exaggerated. There's more than one issue involved. Some people think we must have a metal-backed currency, and I think that's a red herring.
Well, we know we'd like to have this national socialist type system. Well, we've run out of time, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm glad we had this little bit of time to talk. See, we can always fill it up. If we end early. So come back next week, and we're going to have part two, sort of this Paul Warburg Federal Reserve story. Good night.
Rage, rage, I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.